Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is President Trump becoming a Democrat? Again, he was registered as a Democrat from 2001 to 2009, according to New York voting records, and now he's made his second deal with the Democrats in as many weeks.
So let's bring in our politics roundtable. Chad Pergram covers Congress for Fox News. He joins us from Capitol Hill. Hi, Chad.
Thanks for having me.
And Alan Gomez covers immigration for USA Today. He's in Miami, and it sounds like the power is on where you are, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Chad, let me start with you. What exactly did President Trump and Senators Schumer, the New York Democrat, and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi agree to this week on immigration?
That is the big question here. And depending on who you talk to, that is the consternation, because you have people on the right saying, well, they agreed to some permanent fix to allow the DREAM Act folks, 800,000 of them, to be in the United States and do this legislatively sometime in the next few months. Others on the hard right believe this is a cave by the president, said that he has gone back on campaign promises here. One of the most remarkable things I think we had all week was after this bipartisan meeting at the White House with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi at dinner. They had Chinese food on Wednesday night. Was the president sent out some tweets saying there wasn't an agreement, trying to walk this back ever so slightly so he wasn't crossways with his political base. And then you had Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer putting out a joint statement basically doing air cover for his tweets. That's remarkable. If you consider his Twitter feed, that you have the Democratic leaders saying, no, 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 what he said in his Twitter feed is consistent with what we agreed to.
Well, it is pretty remarkable that it ended up, apparently, after last night, being a deal in which there would be an ability for the Dreamers, the so-called Dreamers, to stay in the United States with reinforced security on the border, but with no wall. Look, as you know, Donald Trump's base is livid. Here's conservative commentator and Trump booster Ann Coulter on WBAL yesterday on whether she feels betrayed.
No, I think the country's been betrayed. I think 63 million voters have been betrayed. And I have a little difficulty seeing how Republicans, any Republican, ever get them back.
Well, and so staying with you, Chad, we asked, is he a Democrat? That's what many Republicans are asking. He had been one in the past. Is this has riven the Republican Party since Reagan gave amnesty to people in undocumented in the country. What's the result here?
Well, what we have here is a pragmatism issue for the president. He worked exclusively with Republicans on health care. They couldn't get very far, though they did manage to get something barely through the House by the skin of their teeth. They couldn't move something in the Senate. He is thinking about his long-term legacy, and I'm going to throw some numbers at you here. 217 to 213, that was the vote in the House on health care. You switch two votes, it ties, it's a tie, it fails. 90 Republicans voted against him in the House on the combined bill a couple of weeks ago to fund the hurricane relief efforts, to keep the government open and raise the debt ceiling. 17 in the Senate. He can't govern with only Republicans. And people on Capitol Hill and at the White House are indicating that this is the post-Priebus pivot. Reince Priebus was the former Republican National Committee chair. He was the chief of staff at the White House here. And just working with Republicans in this legislative environment doesn't work. He needs Democrats to get things done. Republicans won't vote for certain things on Capitol Hill.
Well, Alan Gomez, let me bring you in on this. You have been covering this issue so closely for so long. What did you make of this deal? And do you think that this sort of pushes the wall off the table, at least for now, because if he can't get it done now, is he going to be able to do it in a year?
Well, if this deal comes through and they do it without a wall, I mean, he basically loses all his leverage with the Democrats to be able to get something, some kind of money, those big dollars that he wants for expanding the border wall. But I'm not being facetious when I say let's wait to see what President Trump says next week on this, because having covered this issue for so long, it's watching him several years ago before he was running for office. He met with Dreamers. He said he was won over by them. They were fantastic. He runs for office. He runs for the White House, and suddenly he's saying he's going to end the program. He's going to deport them. He wins the election. He starts talking about, oh, I'm going to treat them with great heart. This is going to be they're wonderful people. They're great. And then just a couple of weeks ago, he does the only concrete action on it, which is to end DACA and start phasing it out. And then we're now in this sort of back and forth over these last few days. So, you know, I say all that to make the point that, yes, he's kind of been leaning more towards this deal, and it looks like he's working with the Dems on this one right now. But again, he could change very quickly.
Right.
He's getting annihilated right now online. If you go on Breitbart right now, there's a whole running chain of people showing them burning their Make America Great Again hats. Mm. And so, you know, give it a weekend where he gets a lot of bad coverage in that area from those hardcore supporters, and we might have another ball game next week.
Well, and can I jump back in here for a second?
Yep.
There's one little point that that is very key here. There aren't the votes on Capitol Hill to erect a wall. That's something that has to be passed. Right. There was this bill that threw about $1.6 billion toward border security, which they had to put on another bill back in July, and they had to tack it onto that piece of legislation and say that that was money, a down payment for the wall, because there aren't the votes for a wall. So maybe this, again, is the pragmatism of President Trump.
That's Chad Pergram of Fox News. But Alan Gomez of USA Today, I want to bring you in again, because Maggie Haberman of the New York Times said something interesting this morning. She said advisors told her that President Trump really didn't understand that DACA is a finite program. You have to be brought as a child to the U.S. before 2007. So the population that qualifies is running out. Now, of course, if you listen to some right-wing radio, you don't hear that. You hear that it's an ongoing stream of people. But if this is true, is that encouraging to you that this is a president who, when informed, can change his mind? Or is it alarming if he didn't know?
It's slightly terrifying that the day that he announced that he was ending the program, later that day said that he might reconsider it in 6 months. You know, this is it's so important. Not, you know, let's put aside the politics for a second and understand that this affects nearly 800,000 people who are in this program. So there's that. And you would think that he would have a full understanding of what the program did and what the effects of his actions would be before he announced that he was going to roll out the program. And so, yes, it's encouraging that he's here and all this sort of stuff. But we're sort of seeing, I mean, just a couple hours ago on Twitter, you know, in all caps, he says chain migration cannot be allowed to be part of any legislation on immigration.
Right.
That's clearly in response to what we heard the last couple of days from conservative media arguing that these DACA recipients are going to be able, if they get citizenship, to bring in all their families.
Right, and he said no citizenship, just allowed to stay in the U.S., but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then what? I'm sorry if I'm losing a little bit of track, but I've been in this hurricane and cell phone coverage has been a little bit rough.
Fair enough.
So I'm getting all the information on this in bursts whenever I got cell phone coverage. But, you know, I see him, they ask him about, is this amnesty? He says, no, the word is DACA. And then later on when he lands, he said, no, this is not amnesty. So it's changing so quickly, and the details of this are so critically important that until we start seeing some meat on these bones, it's really hard to understand what this deal could possibly be and what the effect of it would be.
Well, while the president was in the air, he made some news. Let's listen here to what he said. He's kind of going back to blaming both sides in the Charlottesville protests. Here he is talking about the left-wing group Antifa.
You know, you have some pretty bad dudes on the other side also. A lot of people are saying, in fact, a lot of people have actually written, gee, Trump might have a point.
This was a day after having a tete-a-tete with Tim Scott, the only African-American Republican in the Senate. Chad, why does he want to have this conversation again? Because it didn't really end well for him last time.
Well, that demonstrates, you know, a lack of message discipline. This is something that John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, was supposed to bring to this president. But again, you know, he kind of says what he says. And you know, Tim Scott had wanted this meeting, went down to the White House and met with him. You know, there was a resolution that the president just signed last night, which was approved by the House and Senate, which condemned the KKK and white supremacists and neo-Nazis in Charlottesville. And he signed that. So it's interesting to hear him say that at one point. And then, you know, the Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill send him this resolution, something that they designed in such a way to compel him to have to sign it. And he signed it last night. So, again, this is where we're getting these cross messages out of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, Alan Gomez, I want to make sure we ask you, because there you are having, you know, ridden out the storm there in Florida, as you mentioned. What about the president's storm response? He visited yesterday. He's just surrounded by people everywhere he goes, wearing their red hats and their Trump T-shirts. They seem very appreciative of seeing him. But we're learning more about the 8 nursing home deaths in that nursing home that became an oven. The president praised Florida Governor Rick Scott, saying he'd make a great senator. But in Florida, the nursing home industry lobbied against rules that would require generators for air conditioners in those nursing homes. They won. There was no generator for the air conditioners there. That doesn't look good for the Florida governor.
Absolutely not. I mean, in this nursing home story is just it's right when we thought we had gotten past the worst of the storm. We went over there and found out about this, and it was just so horrible and so tragic, and it's going to be one of those defining issues of this hurricane, and just kind of adding to that, when we talk, we see Trump, Pence came down, the FEMA administrator Brock Long has been down. They've been running around and doing a lot of things. And talking quite a bit. But I can tell you from running around Southwest Florida down the Florida Keys yesterday that folks are kind of saying, hey, that's all great, but where's my water? Where's my ice? And it's the FEMA administration was talking about that they're still focused on life safety and life-sustaining issues.
Right.
The Department of Defense at one point said there's maybe 10,000 people in the Florida Keys that might need evacuation. That wasn't the case.
Right.
And so folks are saying, hey, give us our water, give us our ice, stop with the PR, and let's get rolling.
That's Alan Gomez, who covers immigration for USA Today and the hurricane in the last week. Chad Pergram covers Congress for Fox News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
The elderly are very much top of mind with the image of nursing home residents waist-deep in water in Houston or dying from the heat in Florida. While officials there ask how our elderly citizens could be better cared for during a hurricane, Atul Gawande has long asked, how could they be better cared for, period. In his 2014 bestseller, Being Mortal, he admitted that like most doctors, he had a lot to learn. He didn't know that hospices could actually prolong life, or what to ask a patient making end-of-life decisions. Or what to ask when his own father began to fail. So he began studying what was wrong and found people who were doing it right. Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End is now out in paperback. We spoke when the book was first published and started with Bill Thomas, a doctor in New Berlin, New York. As the new medical director of the Chase Memorial Nursing Home, Thomas wanted to try something different.
He walked into this place and felt that there was no life here. And he said, let's bring animals in, let's bring plants in, and that's what he did. He wanted everybody to have a pet, everybody to have an animal that belonged to them.
He brought in 100 birds and established a daycare center for the employees' children, so there were children on site. How do you measure this success? You call this a success story. How's that measured?
He describes people literally waking up, people who were catatonic before started to speak. Then you got numbers like the amount of medications required for sedation and anxiety declined. There was even an increase in how long people survived. People found that there was worth to their days. There was purpose to being alive again, as simple as just being able to care for another being.
But I can just hear someone thinking, how can you just bring animals into a regulated place?
Yeah. You know, it's very telling that we called these places nursing homes. We did not want to admit that these were places where we were trying to manage mortality. And therefore, we didn't try to think hard about what having a good life in such a place might be. We focused on health and safety. And that's why these places became like prisons. But there are places that remade themselves. One version called greenhouses really specifically make it so that the hallways, instead of having just these long hallways with 60 people on them in double occupancy rooms, made private smaller rooms with a dozen people ringed around, instead of a nursing station, around a kitchen. And one of the radical ideas was that anybody could get up and come from their room and go to the kitchen and open the refrigerator and get something that they wanted to eat or drink. People would say, suppose they take a soda out and they're a diabetic, or suppose they're supposed to be on a pureed diet and they eat a cookie. You know what? These are choices people can make. And we live for more than just being safe or surviving. Even people with some severe dementia, they were showing they could be allowed to have choices and freedom. And that gave them a sense of more control over their lives.
Talk about Peter Sanborn Place. It was built in 1983 as a subsidized apartment building for independent, low-income elderly. But then the manager there, Jackie Carson, sounds incredible. She just decided that I'm going to help my tenants as they age.
And as they got older, they got more and more needs. And the home health agency that would get called in would say, oh, these people belong in a nursing home. But Jackie would send them off and they'd be miserable there. So she said, you know what? We're just going to make it so we can keep them at home. And when the home health agency insisted that, well, they won't do it anymore, she started a home health agency of her own where she'd teach the nurses how to make it possible for people to make their own choices like we described, trying to address the fact that, you know, many of these people only have a year or two left in their lives. It can be full of purpose and something other than like bingo and group trips to a museum that none of them are actually excited about.
Increasing their quality of life, even when one of the tenants developed Alzheimer's, a private charity paid for the first overnight healthcare worker. So here's an apartment building with an overnight healthcare worker. I mean, it's thinking outside of the box, but now I can hear people saying, okay, that's one building that got a private charity to help them, but how do you afford it?
It isn't about whether you've spent more or not. It's really about a cultural shift. Jackie Carson, making it possible for a woman with Alzheimer's disease to go out to a restaurant on Fridays with her friends. And you know what? She was diabetic, but she would want a margarita. And on Friday nights, they'd break the rules and she'd get a margarita. That is all the creativity took. It didn't take money. In fact, it often costs less because people's medication needs would go down. Bill Thomas, I described how the work he was doing when they brought the pets in actually lowered the likelihood that patients needed all the different kinds of medications they were on.
Well, it also takes the family signing on because you point out that a lot of the decisions that get made about the elderly, where they'll live and what they'll do, are made by adult children. They want to feel safer. And you may have to let go of some of that. You may have to allow your mother to go to an apartment building where the manager might let them go have a margarita.
Exactly. One of the most fascinating things that someone I spoke to said was, safety is what we want for those we love, but autonomy is what we want for ourselves. And we forget that about our parents, that they're going to have priorities that go beyond just being, quote unquote, safe.
Well, so we've talked about the huge problem of the elderly who can't anymore live alone at home and alternatives to nursing homes that people are coming up with. But there's no getting around the ultimate destination. And you spend a good portion of your book talking about this. And it's really quite poignant because your dad is failing as you are learning the language to speak to him. You know, for instance, you admit early on, you didn't know what hospice care was. You thought it was to hasten death, but actually it extends survival.
Yeah. There's this fascinating study at the Mass General Hospital. They randomized half of stage 4 lung cancer patients who only had on average about 11 months to live. Half of them got usual oncology care, and the other half got the usual oncology care plus saw a palliative care specialist who had discussions with them about their goals for when they get sicker. That group who had the conversations ended up choosing to stop their chemotherapy sooner. They started hospice care earlier. They had less suffering at the end of life. And here was the kicker. They lived 25% longer. Hmm. And that just meant we're making bad decisions by not having the conversations to help people draw lines about when the sacrifices they're going through for the sake of possible time later are starting to exceed the value. A lot of the basic questions that they ask are pretty simple ones we can all ask. What are the trade-offs you're willing to make and not willing to make? What are the goals you have, even if your health worsens?
So, Atul, this idea of asking patients what they want, this meant switching from someone you'd recognized you'd been, which is doctor information. You give the patient all the information about the disease and the surgery and the treatment, and you start switching, sometimes mid-session, to what do you want? What is a goal that you have? How eye-opening was this for you to be, after so many years, realizing, wait a minute, I have to ask them what they want?
It changed my practice pretty fundamentally. The switch to realizing we have to be effective counselors for people, which means asking them some questions that help us understand what they really care about, and then saying, yes, you have option A, B, and C, but I wouldn't do option A or B if what really matters to you is that you don't have your brain fuzzy or that you don't suffer a lot of pain. Maybe it's option C, which has fewer side effects, even though it might be potentially less powerful. Or someone else who says, I'm willing to go through anything for this sliver's chance of a total cure. Okay, then we're going to hit it and we're going to be on it. And we know this is going to be a tough, tough road, but you're willing to take that sacrifice. Different people make different choices, but it's being able to counsel them based on their priorities instead of just laying out the choices and then leaving people puzzled about what to do.
Well, and you know, even as we're speaking, and you acknowledge this, this sounds awfully close to rationing and death panels. How do you deal with that and the fact that, well, you were there? When it's your loved one, you really get tempted to try anything.
A death panel that says you can't have what you care about in your life is what people fear. The panel of doctors and nurses who say, if I understand that this is your priority in life and therefore this is what your best path is, we will provide that path for you. That's like a living panel. And that when my father went through what was a brain cancer and it was not curable, we had these series of conversations. There was a colleague's father who said that what mattered to him is that if I can eat chocolate ice cream and watch football on television, that's good enough for me.
In other words, he might have been paralyzed by an operation, but that was okay as long as he could watch TV.
Yeah. And my dad said, that is not good enough for me. He was a social creature and he wanted to be able to still Skype and see people. Also, he wanted to still make contributions that made a difference in the world. And as long as that wasn't taken away, that's what he was willing to live for. And so that's what we worked to maximize. And it guided when he decided to go for a very aggressive radical operation that did buy him more time without quadriplegia. When he started to become quadriplegic, it guided our decision that he would go for radiation therapy. When that didn't work and it made him worse, it guided decisions that he would not do chemotherapy and go on to hospice. And right through that time, continuing to work on the charity projects he had, having dinner parties and seeing people, it was pretty amazing.
Do you think you got it right for your dad?
I think after 10 years of being a surgeon where I felt we were not getting it right for my patients, I felt like for once with my father, we were getting it right.
Yeah. Atul, we are so sorry for the loss of your dad, but what a great tribute to him this book is. He was also a doctor. So thank you for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The Commerce Department reported today that retail sales, a key measure of consumer spending, fell last month. Now, it was only a 0.2% decrease, but it was unexpected. So is it a sign of the retail apocalypse some have been warning about, or is it just a dip due to Hurricane Harvey, which would figure into the numbers because it happened in August? Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why did retail sales fall?
Well, hurricanes, like you said, definitely are going to somewhat distort all economic reports for the next few months. In this case, the Commerce Department said it couldn't really isolate the effect of Harvey. But in any event, this was not a positive report for the retail industry because the prior month figures were also revised lower. And non-store sales, which includes e-commerce, were down. And the figures showed that August sales of cars and light trucks posted the weakest monthly pace since 2014. We're down about 0.2%. So not a good report overall.
But when you look at some of the other indicators out there, like unemployment, which is very low, I mean, compared to what it has been, certainly, if people have jobs and they're making money, why aren't they spending it in retail?
Well, right. And some of the consumer confidence surveys continue to be either at records or very near record highs, or at least highs for the last 10 years or so. I think there's a few things going on. First, there's just this very, very intense competition these days among retailers, which is preventing retailers from having, you know, what they call on Wall Street pricing power. In other words, the ability to raise prices.
Right.
And also, if you think of the demographics, there's this huge baby boom generation right now. And you know, older people just don't buy as much stuff. And then there's a big millennial generation, and there's just a lot of research that suggests they aren't as conspicuous of consumers as previous generations. Now, maybe that's just an effect of them coming of age during a time when the economy didn't have a lot of oomph behind it. So we'll have to see if that's a long-term trend.
There are also fears in the industry that Amazon is making a big difference in retail sales. Is that playing into this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, of course, in this report, which is official government numbers, online retailers are actually included, and yet they still had a month-on-month decline. Now, part of that is because, remember, Amazon's Prime Day was in July.
Right.
So that's a pretty hard comparison month over month to that. So that's part of it. But obviously, there wasn't enough oomph from online to turn this into a positive number.
So this retail apocalypse that we've been hearing about, is that something that people are talking about, or is this just kind of a blip in the numbers?
Well, I think there's a big distinction to be made between the health of the retail industry itself and the health of the consumer. Like we said, the consumer confidence numbers are great.
Right.
Unemployment number is great. But like I said before, Amazon and Google and the whole modern day e-commerce system has really improved the ability for consumers to find the best possible price. So it's good for consumers, not necessarily great for the industry. And it's hard to imagine it really having any sort of V-shaped rebound where it comes roaring back.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Fall is fast approaching, but according to Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, you can still preserve the taste of summer by canning it. Kathy's here in the studio. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Jeremy.
So canning is one of your favorite end-of-season activities, I hear.
It is. It's kind of a ritual. It's always bittersweet because it means that summer's winding down. But it is a way to preserve summer. And a lot of people will say, why would I do that? It's really a lot of work.
Mm.
And I will not lie. Some of it can be. But the point is that this time of year, everything is so fresh. And the point of canning is that you get the very freshest food you can find, and you harvest it, and you seal it up, and it never gets a minute to decay. Hmm. So you're sort of capturing the best food in the best season and keeping it that way. It's like living forever, except not.
Well, tell us about some of these things that you brought in
okay.
that you've been canning.
Let's start with the simplest ones. These are quick pickles that can also be canned, and I'm going to explain what the difference is. A quick pickle is simply a matter – so, for instance, there are carrots there.
Okay.
These are carrots from the farmer's market, so they were picked that morning. I put them raw into sticks into a jar, a big mason jar, and then I heated up apple cider vinegar and garlic and some chili peppers and poured the hot vinegar solution, a little bit of water, a little bit of salt, over the raw carrot. And I seal it, and I put it in the fridge. Those are 3 days old, and I think they're just fabulous. They're
so fresh.
I'm
just thinking of Chevy Chase in Vegas Vacation telling his kids to try this cookie that's 8 years old.
This is a
little
different.
This is only 3 days. Okay.
But the point is, if I wanted to preserve it for a year, I would can it. And what that means is that I would go through a somewhat technical process of sterilizing my jars. That means cleaning them in hot, hot water with lots of soap, and then you dunk them into a big pot of boiling water. Then I would take them out and dry it. I would put my carrots in. I'd put my hot vinegar solution on top, and I'd seal the jar. And then I would boil them in a canning pot for about 10, 12 minutes. And that would be sealed. Those carrots would keep anywhere for a year and a year and a half.
And there's dill in here, too.
There is also dill in there from my garden. But so the difference is maybe you don't feel like canning. Maybe you just want to do some pickles because you have all these vegetables, but you really don't have the time or the heart commitment to get into all that. So you just pop them in your fridge and they keep for weeks. So next to the carrots are string beans from my garden in rice wine vinegar with big chunks of fresh ginger and some hot spicy sesame oil.
I taste that. There's
right?
A nice
got a little bite.
There.
Isn't that nice? These also are 3 days old and they still have the snap of a fresh green bean,
yeah.
But they're also becoming something else. They're pickles now. Hmm. So it's that simple, a matter of heating up some vinegar and spices and you're there. Okay, so I talked about canning. You seal these jars, you put them in boiling water, and then the big question is, how do you know if it's safe? So I never, ever in my life tell people to talk to the government, but I will in this case. The USDA has a terrific site, which we can link people to, where you can learn all about the technicalities of canning, how to avoid botulism, how to do a quick test so that you're sure that the food that you've canned is safe. But there's a sound involved, okay? This is my homemade roasted tomato sauce. I make this every year. I take all the tomatoes from the garden, chop them up with basil, garlic, olive oil, fresh herbs, put it into a hot, hot oven, and instant sauce. This might be my most famous favorite recipe of my life.
And yet I've never had it before.
Well, you're going to taste it right now. But I want you to listen to something. Next to it is some jam that I made that's been opened. So this is what a jar sounds like when it's not sealed. It kind of wobbles around.
Right.
It bubbles. This is what a jar sounds like when it's sealed. It's like a dull thump. Here's what I do. I'm going to unscrew the ring, and I'm going to try to lift it up just by that inner piece of the ring. It doesn't come up.
Huh.
But I'm going to open it for you. My last jar from 2016.
Here?
You are. Ready?
Yep. Whoa.
Now smell that. That is my garden in a jar.
Ooh.
Right?
Oh, can somebody get some pasta over here?
Taste that straight.
All
it
right.
is that good. Now, you could add anchovies and olives and make it a puttanesca. You could add anything, right?
Yeah.
That, to me, tastes like summer. And you can have it all year and in the dead of winter with some delicious linguine. You know, you're all set. That's the beauty of canning, is that you get all the flavors and colors of summer to use at will.
And how long can you keep them?
A year, a little bit more. It depends what it is. I have some books to recommend and some websites to get into the real technicality of canning, because you do want to be careful. If your jars don't seal and you hear that buckling and that sound, open them up, have a little bit, put it in your fridge and enjoy it.
Now, we also have in front of me what looks like breakfast.
Breakfast, yeah, or dessert, actually.
Or dessert.
At the farmer's market, there are these gorgeous plums, perfectly ripe. So I made a conserve. It's not quite as thick as a jam or a jelly, but I toasted a baguette for you with some butter. And that is just plums with a little bit of sugar, not overly sweet, but you should really taste the fruit.
Mm. But I love plums, too.
I do, too. And that's what jams and jellies should be about the taste of the fruit. I also brought you a bowl of plain yogurt, sprinkled a little bit of maple syrup around it, and put the plum conserves smack in the middle of it. That would be a really beautiful dessert or breakfast.
Oh, that's delicious.
Isn't that nice? So the thing about canning is it can be pickles, like for an antipasto platter, a first course. It can be a tomato sauce, which could be your main course, or desserty, sweet jams, jellies, capturing all the fruits of summer.
We will put all of these recipes up at our website, hereandnow.org. A lot of canning to be done for people. Maybe they don't know anything about it, but we've got the tips at the website as
well.
And
also, it's really fun to have a party and do it with a group of people and share the labor and turn it into a really fun day of canning.
And everybody gets to have some of that sauce.
Everyone takes it home and everyone's happy.
Kathy Guntz, Here and Now resident chef. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And just like canning, buck dancing requires some patience and guidance. If you've never heard of buck dancing, you're about to find out what it is. A program in Tennessee has linked artistic masters with young apprentices. Tony Gonzalez from WPLN has the story.
In a corner of a brewery, a circle of old-time musicians pluck, strum, and holler. They're already at it when the buck dancer steps to the board at the center of their ring.
Yeah.
It's Thomas Maupin, a scrawny 78-year-old whose elbows, hips, and knees jingle like a country puppet above his clacking black shoes.
A buck dancer
dance to that tune that they're playing and be part of that music, is trying to match that music, be a part of the band.
Well, Thomas looks at it like, you know, he's improvising and expressing himself musically. He's hearing what you're doing, and then you're hearing what he's doing, and it's an exchange.
That's Rob Piercy, multi-instrumentalist folk musician. For years, he's played behind Maupin in Southern buck dancing competitions. The style is less showy than clogging and more musical, like flat-footed tap dance. And lately, Maupin's been passing this on to someone more than 50 years his junior.
Well, I'm Courtney Williams. I play old-time music with my family, and I've been going to local festivals all my life, seeing Thomas dance and other people dance.
And now studying with him, although there's no classroom or formal rehearsal space.
It's kind of hard for Thomas to explain what he does because it just comes so natural to him. So he'll show you the basic stuff, and then it's like, and then you just do this.
But Maupin says she caught on quickly.
When we first started, I just deal with a toe and a heel, toe and a heel.
Well, I try to get as close to Thomas's dancing as I can just because I think a lot of people don't dance like him, and I want to kind of preserve what he does.
This night is prime for practice, with the hardwood floors, a capacity crowd, and Maupin setting the pace. They trade licks, both always in motion. When Williams is on a good run, Maupin hoots. It's encouragement for the future of buck dancing.
Oh, I think it's here to stay, and hey, and I'm trying my best to help it. I'm not the best. I'm good as the rest.
Some may beg to differ. Thomas Maupin has been named a National Heritage Fellow this year. But the way he sees it, the future doesn't hinge on him. A resurgence of old-time music means plenty of musicians circling up the space in the middle for the next buck dancer. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Gonzalez in Nashville.
The Caribbean island of St. Martin, half Dutch, half French, was one of the hardest hit by Hurricane Irma. Earlier on, there were fights over food and looting. More than a week later, food, fuel, any power are rare. Almost all structures are damaged, no schools. CNN's Clarissa Ward is on St. Martin. Clarissa, the last time we talked to you, you were in a Syrian town, reduced to rubble. Of course, this isn't war. But what do you think when you see St. Martin?
I think what's really striking about St. Martin is, first of all, it seems an incongruous place to see this kind of devastation. We're used to thinking about the Caribbean in the context of this beautiful vacation destination, a paradise for tourists. And so to see this level of damage and destruction, the likes of which, yes, I would say I am more accustomed to seeing in a war zone, it is somehow jarring. It's also jarring, I would say, to see how long it has taken authorities here, and I should emphasize that I'm on the French side of the island. It's really taken a very long time for them to get a basic trickle of aid into the hardest hit areas. Up until just really today, they've been so focused on really just getting out a small amount of rations of food, of getting some drinking water to people. And when you see places where this food and water is being handed out, it's quite chaotic. There's a crush of people clamoring to get their hands on a couple of bottles of drinking water. It's a little upsetting to see that in a place where we traditionally think of it as being a kind of beautiful escape in the Caribbean, in paradise.
Well, it is a French territory, so France, an efficient country, perhaps there was no place to land. But yeah, we're reading accounts of when people are getting these food stuffs that were on hand handed out. It's things like frozen chicken or a 3-pound bag of mozzarella cheese, you know, and there's nothing, they can't cook, there's nothing to do with it.
I think there is a lot of frustration. If you talk to residents here, they feel very let down by the French. They cannot believe that a week after this hurricane, the French authorities are really still struggling to get this basic aid out, to get running water back up, because that's the real concern right now. People are able to kind of survive on the food that they have, but there is a real concern now about the potential for disease and the potential for some kind of outbreak, but also just these mountains of trash alongside every street. I can't tell you, Robin, the smell, this putrid smell of rotting garbage. And, of course, wherever you have giant piles of rotting garbage, you have rats.
Yeah.
And wherever you have rats, you have disease.
Well, and we know that more people die from a lack of clean drinking water, water for sanitation, than any other thing in a disaster. It's the water that they die from. But we're also reading reports of doctors on the island saying that they doubt the death toll so far. I mean, something like 11. But they feel that there's going to be many, many more, maybe even hundreds, because of the flattening of the island. Is that your sense?
It's so difficult to get a sense of what the reality is on the ground vis-a-vis death tolls, vis-a-vis the situation with injured people. We know that the hospital was evacuated, and every day we have seen ambulances ferrying around the island, taking people, some of whom appear to be in pretty bad shape, to be honest, to the airport to try to get them out to the nearest island, the nearest French island, I should say, which is Guadeloupe. They're being evacuated to that hospital. We don't know exactly how many people were killed in this storm. What I would also say is, whether the death toll is higher or not, one thing is clear. A lot of people are skeptical of what they're hearing because, as I said before, not a lot of trust and definitely some resentment. They're saying, listen, the storm happened a week ago and we knew that Irma was coming for days. How could we be so poorly prepared all this time later?
Questions that have to be answered. Just quickly, though, are you seeing signs of resilience? I mean, how are the people coping?
I mean, I'm really glad you brought that up, because it is the one encouraging thing you do see after natural disasters, and you're definitely seeing it in St. Martin. There is an incredibly strong spirit of resilience, an incredibly strong spirit of community, people banding together. There are lots of different nationalities living here, French on the French side, Dutch on the Dutch side, but also a large amount of Jamaicans, Haitians, people from Puerto Rico, people from all over. And there's a tremendous spirit of unity. We see people out on the streets every day with their bare hands, clearing debris, sweeping up. A lot of the people we ask, you know, are you going to try to evacuate? Are you going to try to go to Guadeloupe? But it's remarkable how many people want to stay here, how many people want to rebuild this island, and how much kindness there is in terms of pooling resources and working together to do the best they can in incredibly trying circumstances.
That's CNN's Clarissa Ward on St. Martin. She's on the French side as we speak. Clarissa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And, you know, tourism officials are hearing from people who still want to come to places like St. Martin. Voluntourism, they want to help. We'll hear about that on Monday. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.